All right. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Werke, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this February 16 Zoom session of the Court of Appeals for this panel. Counsel, as you are aware, and as I've just mentioned, we are not live today in person, but we are handling our oral argument via the Zoom platform. So just bear in mind that two things. One, if the technology becomes glitchy, just let us know. If you have a hard time hearing or seeing anyone who's participating, that includes any of the judges or your opponent counsel, just flag us somehow and we'll try to pause and let the technology catch up. Also, even though we can see each other and see each other's names, we are only making an audio recording of the proceedings. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that we can later attach the argument to the right attorney. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Let me just verify that our first case today is the State of Minnesota versus Ferguson. Counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, the appellant's counsel has the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Michael Ferguson. Mr. Ferguson was convicted of second-degree murder following a jury trial in Hennepin County. I raised four issues in my brief that standing alone and cumulatively warrant reversal. Today, I'd like to address two issues that had the most impact on trial: the improper self-defense instruction and the prosecutor's elicitation of inadmissible character and other bad acts evidence.
I'm going to take you off your track because I'd like you to address your first argument, actually, in your brief, the argument about self-defense, because I'm just wanting to get my mind around what exactly your position is in your argument. You seem to be basing the argument on the issue of whether or not your client had a reasonable basis to believe he was in fear on facts that were surrounding the events leading up to the first shot being fired. As I read your brief, that seems to be your position. But am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So as I watch the video, shouldn't our concern on that issue should be based upon the facts as they existed at the time of the fatal shooting, not the time of the first shot, but the fatal shot. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I would also suggest that what happened leading up to that, him firing the shot, plays into whether his fear was reasonable. All of the things that happened before led into whether his fear
was reasonable. Right, no, I understand that, but he has to have a reasonable fear at the time that he fired the fatal shot.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And at the time— I'm gonna pause you for just one moment and have the marshal pause the clock. I think we've dropped Judge Kirk, seems to have vanished, and I wanna make sure he's still on the proceeding. Judge Kirk, are you still there? Well, let's make sure that he has a chance to get reconnected. Jamie, are you okay? Can you try to get Judge Kirk back on? Sorry, everyone. This is the nature of technology. It's a blessing and a trial at the same time.
In the webinar I was referring to, that's what I said, is the constant fear that, you know, as judges, we're not necessarily any more masterful of Zoom technology or other technology. So you just kind of need to disappear.
And we're all dependent upon whatever kind of bandwidth and all the magic that happens that I couldn't explain to anyone But we all know we need to be connected. And the advantage, of course, is now you both get to gather your thoughts. And Ms. Martin, you could try to figure out where this is going, and you're ready to knock it out of the park when we get back in online. If you can reach him by phone, and maybe if necessary, we could have him. Oh, I see him trying to log back on.
Means
well, just to be clear, that was at the time that he fired the first shot. I just want to, when I look at the video evidence, mm-hmm. you correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears as if the victim ran about 6 or 7 steps before he fell. And it appears that, that he began running at the same time that the entire crowd reacted physically to what appears to be the first shot. Would you agree with me so far that that's what the record would indicate?
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
And at the time that the victim fell, your client was in a car that had traveled away from the point of the conflict, away from that point where you say your client was afraid of the circumstances, so far that he was already off the screen. Would you agree with that as well?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But I would note that this all happened in an extremely fast period of time. I mean, it's just a matter of
sure.
seconds.
It was just seconds. But would you agree with me that given the cause of death, a single gunshot to the brain, that the shot that killed the victim occurred not the first time your client fired the gun, but after multiple shots, after the victim had run 7 feet, or 7 steps, I should say, or 6 or 7 as I count them?
I don't know that we can judge which gunshot. I mean, again, like these gunshots were fired, it appears, rapidly. So there was not, it does not appear that there was a pause and then another shot fired.
No, I understand that, but if your client was concerned about making sure that he was safe and leaving the scene, as you argue and as he testified, with everyone running away and him having driven out of the frame entirely, would you agree with me that at the time of the fatal shot, the victim and your client were moving in opposite directions, one in a car and one on foot?
That appears to be the case, Your Honor.
Okay, so why would we, but what is the, isn't there only one inference to be drawn from that, which is that at the time that the fatal shot was fired, there is no reason for anyone to believe, for your client to have believed, that he was in any danger whatsoever, whether from being shot or from being beaten up, as he originally said?
I don't think that's true, Your Honor, because the threat was to shoot up the car. And then Mr.
Ms. Martin, don't we look at what the jury heard? The jury did hear him say that he was in fear that they would shoot up the car. The jury heard that and they disregarded that. And prior to or while this was going on, you know, your damning evidence is the video. It's a full minute and a half that this car is sitting there, apparently on the video, not blocked or encumbered by another car in front of it. So why would we make that inference when the jury did hear that and heard what he said and disbelieved it?
The jury did hear that, but getting into the second issue, or the issue that I plan to talk about today, and I can certainly go back to the sufficiency argument as well, the jury was operating under the wrong self-defense standard. The Minnesota Supreme Court and this court have made absolutely clear that self-defense instructions must be crafted with analytic precision. The cases also make clear that when the defendant claims the killing was unintentional, the court must provide the general self-defense instruction and not the instruction for justifiable taking of life. And this court has made clear that which instruction is provided depends on the defense theory. It does not depend on the state's theory of the case. In this case, the defense theory was clear. He did not intend to fire to kill anyone. He fired to disperse the crowd so that he could escape.
Counsel, I have a problem with that whole concept. He didn't shoot at the ground. He didn't shoot over their heads. He didn't shoot at the building. He shot at them. Isn't that intent to kill? I mean, when I was duck hunting, if I took a shot, just a flock shot at a bunch of ducks, I was hoping one would fall down dead. What point was there, if you just wanted to scare him, what point was there to continue firing anywhere near that group after the first shot? Once he fires the first shot and they start to leave, nobody's even facing him. They've all turned to run. He travels probably 100 feet down that street or more because he had 4 or 5 seconds before the kill shot. He had to be positioning himself to lean out of the window to the back at a very extreme angle to continue firing at the group of people. I mean, I'm not sure he was even entitled to a self-defense instruction at all at that point.
Well, the to address a couple points. First of all, the question about was this intentional? The jury rejected the intentional counts. They found that this was not an intentional killing by finding him not guilty of first degree and second degree intentional murder. The question of whether he was entitled to a self-defense instruction is gathered from the totality of the circumstances here. And the court determined—
We have to acknowledge that Ferguson himself requested both instructions. He requested both theories be presented to the jury. So if we're gonna be looking at this under a plain error analysis, what you need to, of course, show that in fact, that he was prejudiced by this. And I'm not sure that you can do that when you have invited error.
Carradine makes clear that the plain error standard applies even if the error is invited. So the standard is the plain error standard here. The error was plain because case law makes clear that when the defense theory is that the shooting was unintentional or the killing was unintentional, the defense is entitled to the general self-defense instruction. In regards to prejudice, this case is very similar to Pollard. The instruction provided imposed a greater fear of harm requirement. And the level of harm feared in this case was an issue. In Pollard, the issue was whether she merely feared being hit or killed. If she merely feared being hit, that was bodily injury and she couldn't use deadly force. This court in Pollard made very clear that the jury is free to accept or reject parts of any witness's testimony, including the defendant's. And in this case, the state's theory throughout was that Mr. Ferguson showed up to a clean fight or a fist fight with a gun. The jury could have accepted part of that all this was going to be a fight and that all he reasonably feared was bodily injury.
Can you address a legal question for me? I don't know that the case law is especially clear on it. Maybe you can provide some illumination for us. Obviously, it's possible to have a plain error, even if the error is invited. But can you tell us what your position is as to how the invited nature of the error affects the substantial rights element of the plain error test? It seems to me that it does have some impact, at least at that point, that it's less likely for our court to find that your client's or any client's substantial rights are violated, even if there's error and even if it's plain, in the case of an opportunity not to have the error and an effort by your client to make sure that both instructions were given.
Carradine suggests that the invited error doctrine does not apply if there is plain error. So there is no different application of the substantial rights analysis under an invited error standard. We just apply the plain error standard.
Right, but you're right, we still apply the plain error standard, but the plain error standard includes a case-specific analysis of whether a defendant's substantial rights were violated by the error. And then you have this the extra factor, which is whether correcting the error is necessary in the interest of justice. Maybe that's where the hiccup comes in, at least a little bit from my perspective, but you can disabuse me of that if you wish.
My understanding from reading Carradine is that if there is plain error, the plain error standard applies, and that there is no different analysis based on whether the error was invited or not. The question is whether the error impacted the verdict. Baird says the question for assessing prejudice is whether there's a reasonable likelihood that a properly instructed jury could have accepted the defendant's self-defense claim. And here, given the unique circumstances of this case, where there's competing theories about, you know, whether he feared bodily injury according to the state, or whether he feared great bodily harm or death according to Mr. Ferguson. The erroneous instruction in this case really played right into the state's theory. The state repeatedly pointed out through closing argument that no one else had a gun, and the implication was that he had no reason to fear great bodily harm or death. A properly instructed jury would consider whether he feared bodily injury. It's also important here that the evidence was not overwhelming. That's not the only factor for this court to consider, but it's an important factor. There is nothing in the video that contradicts Mr. Ferguson's version of events. He was outnumbered, he feared for his life, he felt he could not flee without firing to disperse the crowd. I'm not so sure
I would agree with you that the evidence is not overwhelming. The evidence is certainly overwhelming that he fired the fatal shot. And it seems to me the evidence is overwhelming that at the moment he fired the fatal shot, there was a considerable distance between the victim and your client, and they were moving in two different directions. In fact, everyone in the crowd was moving away from from your client, as Judge Kirk points out, at the time of the fatal shooting. I'm not persuaded that the evidence was anything less than overwhelming.
But that's not the only factor for this court to consider again. The error in this case was prejudicial because it went directly to the contested issue in the case, and the jury could have reached a different verdict under the general instruction. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of additional time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the state.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm because the five claims appellant raises on appeal do not warrant reversal or new trial. Based on the court's questioning and comments so far, I plan to keep my argument brief, but I'd like to start by elaborating on a point that Judge Werke had brought up and Judge Ross had also brought up regarding the first issue. What are the facts that the jury accepted that this court must analyze in determining whether the state disproved beyond a reasonable doubt at least one element of self-defense? And in particular, appellant relies on two facts to support a reasonable basis for his fear of bodily harm, great bodily harm, or death. And that is, appellant allegedly, quote, thought, unquote, he heard Dion Watkins say, "Blick up the car if he moves." That testimony was equivocal.
Can I pause you for a big picture question?
Sure.
The appellant argues that this is a matter of circumstantial evidence. I don't think your brief makes especially clear the state's position as to whether we're looking at this from a circumstantial or direct evidence perspective. Can you inform us? It would help if your briefing was more clear on that, but now can you tell us?
Yes, my apologies for not making my brief more clear. I did include the standard for both direct and circumstantial evidence for this court's analysis, but I certainly did not clarify that the video evidence in this case is direct evidence, regardless of whether or not it has audio. Unpublished case law from this court says that, and direct evidence leads a direct link, shows direct, the action. It's the same as live testimony. Yep.
Direct evidence of every element of self-defense?
Not necessarily. Certainly, the reasonableness of appellant's fear could also be supported by circumstantial evidence. And the circumstantial evidence, meaning what he thought, what appellant thought at the time.
Clarify for us the state's position. Which element was proved by, which element of self-defense were proved by direct evidence and which were proved by circumstantial evidence?
With regard to the self-defense claim, each of those elements were disproved beyond a reasonable doubt by at least direct evidence, just looking at what happened. It's also supported by the circumstantial evidence, the inferences you can draw from.
Pause for a minute.
Yep.
How was the subjective belief of Mr. Ferguson proved by direct evidence?
By looking at the acts that took place on the surveillance video, including the particular fact that Judge Ross, you sort of honed in on during appellant's first 15 minutes, the distance and direction of travel between the late victim, Kyrian Watkins, and appellant in this case.
I was focused on the reasonableness of his belief, not whether he had an actual and honest belief. How is the video direct evidence of what's going on in his head?
Well, the argument is his actions do speak for themselves. And I'm not saying that only direct evidence supports the state's disproval beyond a reasonable doubt, but circumstantial evidence certainly supplants that, supplements
I'm just trying to get a sense of, my mind around your argument. So wouldn't you agree that only circumstantial evidence supports the state's position as to the actual intent or knowledge or understanding of fear?
Your Honor, the reason why I can't agree to that and I'm pushing back on that is because intent can be inferred by the direct actions. If you point a gun and shoot at someone, the action speaks for itself.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Isn't the inference drawn from action necessarily circumstantial? Isn't that what circumstantial evidence is? Evidence that requires an inference?
I don't disagree with that general statement, no. But the importance of the direct video evidence here is that the jury was not wondering what happened. The jury saw it minute by minute and second by second, everything leading up to that fatal shot, just as Your Honor had described during appellant's first 15 minutes. So even if there is a combination of the two, both direct and circumstantial evidence, disproving each element of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt, the two facts that appellant continues to rely on about his reasonable belief is the equivocal testimony of appellant thought he heard Deion Watkins say, "Blick up the car." And at that point, Deion Watkins had walked away from the car, uninvolved after that point. Then you have this second allegation of apparently Kyrian saying, "Blow, blow," which was also clearly rejected by the jury and is unsupported by anything in the record because, as the jury reasonably understood, why on earth would Kyrian instruct others to shoot at a car that he was standing nearby? That is just nonsensical, and the jury clearly rejected that. So those two facts that upon which appellant relies for his self-defense arguments were disregarded.
How do we know the jury rejected that? Is it possible that the jury just believe that, but thought that the force that was used was an unreasonable amount of force? Isn't that a possible way to construe the verdict?
No, it's not. And the standard is it a rational conclusion or a rational hypothesis? And that is not. You wouldn't stand next to a car and then instruct people to shoot at the car. You're in between the shot and alleged gun-carrying men. That is not a rational hypothesis of what happened here, and there's no record evidence to support that Chiron would have done that.
You seem to be arguing that no one who's reasonable at the crime scene, you seem to be making a conflation between what might have been reasonable for people to do in the middle of a conflict, and we're talking about likely unreasonable people, and the reasonableness of a jury's decision and the reasonableness of the evidence bearing on the decision. I'm not sure your argument really gets at or accurately applies the circumstantial evidence standard.
And I guess, Your Honor, the basis of that is juries are instructed every day to use their common sense when assessing proof beyond a reasonable doubt. They're assessing the circumstances, and then on a scrutinous review on appeal, it seems different to parse through what is a possible hypothesis and what is a reasonable hypothesis. And so that is the basis for my argument, Your Honor. The jury was supposed to use common sense in that circumstance. But again, the two facts upon which appellant continues to rely on appeal to support his claim that the state did not disprove beyond a reasonable doubt his self-defense claim, this court doesn't include those facts in its analysis because the jury clearly rejected all of them. And if I could move on to the prejudice argument regarding
I just want to get back for just a second at the point that the car moves and the shots fired. It seems like, you know, there's this minute and a half or so where he's seated in the car and different people are kind of talking to him through the window, a couple different guys anyway. And during that period of time, the fellow who ends up being the victim finishes a beer behind the sidewalk, behind everybody, and he just kind of wanders and almost stumbles up to the car, and he says something that ignites the flame that starts everything. So when you say that there's no evidence that he said boom, boom or something, I look at that video, he said something that threw the match on the gas that was poured on the concrete in front of that car.
Your Honor, may I clarify? Are you saying that the video shows Chiron was drinking and stumbling and then approaching the car at the last moment?
Yeah. He's the guy in the blue shirt, right?
In the blue ombre hooded sweatshirt. Ombre, right. Light blue on top, dark blue on the bottom.
Looks tall and thin.
I don't recall him holding something. I would have to go back.
It's before he walks up to the car. He's standing kind of in the background, kind of even with the car, but behind some other guys, and he's drinking a beer. And then he finishes the beer, he throws it on the lawn, and he starts walking kind of to his left, and you're not sure what he's going to do, and then he turns and walks straight up to the car. Mm-hmm. And when he's doing that, he looks to me like he stumbles a little bit, or that he isn't, you know, not necessarily that he's impaired, but he doesn't walk in a smooth, crisp manner in any way. He gets up to the kind of the back window of the car and he's right there. You're right. If somebody was to start shooting the car, he'd be in danger. But, you know, people don't do smart things in these circumstances. That to me isn't an issue that really helps you. But it seems to me from watching the video that whatever he says triggers everything.
Your Honor, I'll just add to the facts here. The jury already heard that everyone involved was at a liquor store immediately prior to coming to the fight. There's a group of people wanting to see a fight. And appellant himself admits he was at the liquor store before doing that as well. I think the jury heard that and they still decided to reject the self-defense theory because common sense says a man is not going to stand in the way of shots that he is allegedly ordering at the car. And
you're assuming that's why the jury decided what they decided. To me, it's obvious they decided it because he had a clear path of retreat. And once he failed to retreat when he needed to, self-defense is gone. Why wouldn't the jury find that?
Well, Your Honor, the state's evidence and the totality of the record here disproves every element beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the state's position that there was no reasonable hypothesis that any of those elements of self-defense was not disproved beyond a reasonable doubt, especially his allegedly reasonable belief that he feared for his life.
Well, I'm not clear as to your answer to Judge Kirk's original question, which is you had said that there is no evidence to support the statements were made that would put him in fear that his car was going to be shot at. Mm-hmm. And the evidence shows that there was a conversation that was occurring beside the car. He testified that statements were made that would indicate to him that someone might start shooting at the car. I mean, I appreciate that your view that you want to convince a jury that maybe that didn't happen. But at this point, when we're considering the evidence, I'm not sure how you can state that there is no evidence whatsoever to support his belief that he heard those things.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can elaborate on the response a bit more now. Thank you for pointing that out, Judge Ross. Kyrian's approach to the car and reach into the back seat indicates that Kyrian was having some sort of interaction or conversation with Damian Young, who was seated in the back seat. So just by alleging that appellant heard Kyrian say something that sounded like blow or something like that, it doesn't make it any more or less likely that that actually occurred. It could have been anyone approaching the car and saying whatever they wanted. And then the problem with that is Kyrian is not animated at all during this entire exchange. You have minutes where you can sort of see the dynamics play out between certain men in the group and appellant.
I don't understand why that matters at all. You seem to be making an argument that you would make to the jury, not an argument that you would make on appeal when we're looking at the facts that might be inferred from the evidence. Mm-hmm. When you've got an eyewitness who is the defendant saying, this is what I heard. And what I heard developed in me a fear that the car was about to be shot. I mean, there's an old maxim in the art of war, which is never defend a weak position. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think you have stronger arguments, but you seem to be really focusing on the idea that there was no support whatsoever for the defendant's testimony that he heard people say the things that led him to believe the car was about to be shot.
Your Honor, I am trying my best to answer your question on that particular point. And the whole point is it's not just any possible belief that something may or may not have occurred. We're talking about rational hypotheses other than guilt here. And so the totality of the video evidence, the lack of animosity between Kyrian and defendant.
So just to be clear, you're saying it would be irrational for us to conclude that the jury may have believed the defendant when the defendant said, I was afraid for my life and I heard these things that put me in fear for my life before I fired the first shot. You're saying that's irrational.
Yes, and this court shouldn't even consider those two facts because not under these standards is this court allowed to take those into consideration. And I apologize, I'm over my time.
You don't have to apologize. We're the one who drug you over your time. So.
No
thank
need
you. To apologize. Is there? I want to make sure that the judges have had a chance to ask any questions they'd like to ask before you can be relieved of the floor.
Can I ask just a real short question? Certainly. What kind of gun was used in this case?
It was a handgun.
I know it was a handgun.
A
was
silver
it a Glock?
Handgun.
What gun was it?
I would have to look back at the transcript, Your Honor. Was
it a revolver or a semi-automatic?
I believe it was a semi-automatic shot with his left hand as he turned 180 degrees around to raise it parallel to the ground and shoot right at the men in the building.
Was he left-handed?
Yes.
Okay. Any further questions? Doesn't appear. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address the question that Judge Werke asked about providing the two instructions. I don't know that I fully addressed that. Providing the two instructions did not make the error less prejudicial for a few reasons. First of all, the court did not explain which standard to apply. So it didn't tell the jury, if you believe that the shooting was unintentional or the killing was unintentional, follow the general. And if you believe that it was intentional, follow the standard for justifiable taking of life. The instruction itself suggests that the justifiable taking of life standard is used whenever a death results. And it's also important with regards to prejudice that the jury asked a question about the language in the justifiable taking of life standard. The word perceived that it was asking about is only in the greater standard. It's not in the general standard. Again, this case is very similar to Pollard in terms of harm. The defense in this case was that he feared great bodily harm or death. But the state really chipped away at that through opening statement, questioning Detective Porras, questioning Mr. Ferguson, and in closing argument about how Mr. Ferguson was the only one shown on that video who had a gun. So the jury very well could have accepted that part of the theory and believed that the only thing that Mr. Ferguson feared was an assault. Sorry, were you asking a question?
would you agree with me that if we base our analysis of the critical moment on the moment that the fatal shot was fired, and we conclude that the evidence shows indisputably that the fatal shot was fired when the victim was and everyone else was had turned from your client, and your client had driven from the point of dispute, that your argument on the likely prejudicial effect is substantially weakened?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that's because everything happened so fast, and this was a highly stressful situation, obviously. It's not like there was an appreciable pause and you know, that would indicate any sort of aiming at Kyrian Watkins.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be any appreciable pause to indicate aiming. We know that your client acknowledged during his testimony that he kept the gun level with the crowd. He was firing toward the crowd, and he in fact shot the man who was standing right next to the car that he was having the conflict with. So I'm not sure that you're correct, that it matters that this happened quickly. And we have quite a few cases where and I know this is not an intentional homicide case, but we have quite a few cases where the case law says you can form intent, even premeditation, in a very short instance. So I'm not sure that the length here is so substantial. The length between the time that they were separating and the time of the fatal shot, I'm not sure that is as insubstantial as you're suggesting.
This would be a question for the jury though, Your Honor. And a jury who was properly instructed might have come to a different conclusion. A jury that was properly instructed might have come to the conclusion that if all he feared was bodily harm, he had no real avenue of retreat aside from firing a gun to disperse the crowd. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is, as this court pointed out, once Mr. Ferguson got in the car, Ms. Johnson did not drive away for about a minute and a half. We don't know why Ms. Johnson wasn't driving away. So the jury could have determined that his only avenue of retreat, aside from firing a gun to disperse the crowd, was to get out of the car and flee. Mr. Ferguson was not in control of the car at that point. Again, this is a question for the jury. Mr. Ferguson claimed self-defense. He had a due process right to a fair trial. and he had a right to have his claim considered by a jury that was applying the correct standard, and also his decision-making was not clouded by all of the other errors in the misconduct in this case. Mr. Ferguson asks this court to reverse his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. It doesn't seem that there's any other questions from the panel. So thank you both for your argument today. Sorry for the little technological glitch, but I'm glad we got through and we made sure that everyone had time for the argument. Thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted and under advisement. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you.
Thank you both, and have a great day.
You too.